It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's current electoral maps had a big impact on the state legislature almost as soon as they were put in place in 2011. We'll find out what changed in the next episode of the WPR podcast, Mapped Out. First, in a reversal last week, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and 10 other Republicans helped Democrats raise the debt ceiling, for now. The move sparked criticism of McConnell from members of his own party, and it kicked the next debt ceiling fight just weeks down the road to early December. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about that story and why political watchers have their eye on next month's race for governor in Virginia. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about Republicans and Democrats coming together last week to raise the debt limit for a little while? Are you nervous about the next debt ceiling fight right around the corner? Is this a way to run things with these frequent near flirtations with a shutdown or some sort of default? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Francesca Chambers is the White House correspondent for McClatchy. Francesca, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get to those stories I just mentioned, you are fresh out of a White House event, I understand, from the president talking about our supply chain. What did we hear?
Well, we did hear the president say that they would now be running those ports 24/7, essentially trying to save Christmas, as some people have put it, telling people that they would be able to get their goods and services, including toys, in time for Christmas. And so good news, potentially, for kids around the country.
All right. Now on to our planned program here, Francesca. We had this debt ceiling standoff, yet another one. We've had a lot of these over the years. We saw Senate Minority Leader McConnell, as I mentioned, change his tune, help raise the debt ceiling for now. After all, what do we know about that change of mind?
Well, here's where it comes down as to whether or not Republicans did or didn't help Democrats raise the debt ceiling. What they voted to do was to help overcome a procedural hurdle that would allow a vote to move forward on the debt ceiling. So that vote itself took place along party lines, 50 to 48. Even since then, however, McConnell has said that he won't help the White House and Democrats again if they reach that December 3rd date in which they expect the money to run out again. He said that to a letter in President Joe Biden.
Right. That's a more accurate way to phrase it. They voted to stop preventing Democrats, in effect, from raising the debt ceiling. Is that a better portrayal?
Well, they voted to not allow a filibuster or end a filibuster, however you want to put it, keep a filibuster from taking place. And so they did not vote for the extension of the debt limit. They just said, hey, we're going to move out of the way.
McConnell got some criticism from people in his own party on this, including former President Donald Trump. Here's what the former president said at a rally in Iowa over the weekend.
And to think that we had 11 Republicans go along with an extension. Headed up by Mitch McConnell. Can you believe that? Mitch McConnell. 11 Republicans. And you know what it does? It gives the Democrats more time, 2 months, gives them more time to figure it out. They can now have 2 more months to figure out how to screw us, okay?
So Mitch McConnell has figures, including the former president, looking over his shoulder on decisions like this. You've been thinking about this, Francesca. What can you tell us about some of the pushback we saw?
Well, there has been pushback besides Donald Trump within the Republican Party. It was primarily, it's worth noting, Republican leadership in the Senate that voted in favor of allowing Democrats to be able to pass a debt ceiling lift. And so it would also included members who are retiring. So they are maybe not as concerned, some of those members, about what the former president of the United States has to say about them, because they will not be running again. But importantly, McConnell did say to the president and to the White House that when it comes to December 3rd, the new date for when this would run out, he is not going to help them. Republican leadership will not help them. And so they're going to have to come up with their own plan for how they would extend it beyond that time frame.
And the politics of this is kind of weird, Francesca, because as I understand it, nobody actually wants the U.S. government to default on their debt. Nobody in leadership, I think most of Congress, would say, yeah, we don't want to risk this possible economic calamity. The idea here is, though, that come December, Democrats will have to figure out a way to do it on their own through some sort of reconciliation, right? What's the politics behind that?
Well, part of what this is too is potentially a misunderstanding about what lifting the debt ceiling actually does. Mm-hmm. Now, there is an argument from Republicans that they don't want to pay for any new spending that President Biden and his party could enact as part of their spending bill, the reconciliation bill that they're trying to work out now. But what the debt ceiling lifting it would do is it would allow the country to pay its past bills, its prior bills. And this is a push that the White House is really making, is to say, no, this is previous spending. This really has nothing to do with the reconciliation bill, and trying to separate those two things out in an effort to try and get more Republicans on board.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I think the guest is bringing up some really good points. I was just calling to say that I think ridiculous of Republicans and very Machiavellian to play chicken with the debt ceiling and whether or not they'll allow Democrats to pass a measure to raise it, especially considering the fact that they have passed it multiple times, raised it multiple times before under Republican-controlled administrations, and they are only recalcitrant to pass it when they can make it look like it was the Democrats' fault.
Michael, thanks for the call. Francesca, Michael taking a long view of the politics of these debt ceiling games of chicken, he called it.
And importantly, we've been talking about the Senate, but in the House of Representatives, the bill also passed along a party line vote. It was House Democrats who voted to lift the debt ceiling, with House Republicans standing in opposition to that. So also important to note that this has become very political, as you were saying before, between Republicans and Democrats.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Francesca Chambers from McClatchy about some of the big stories in national politics. We'll get to have more debt ceiling discussions come December or in late November, I guess. Francesca, I want to move on now to a race in Virginia, a governor's race in Virginia. You don't see a lot of elections in these odd numbered years. Why is this getting so much national political attention?
Well, after the victory of Governor Gavin Newsom in California, Democrats were riding high. And now when you look at Virginia, which with President Biden, you know, won by 10 points, but not nearly the 30 points that he won California in the last election, the race has become much closer. And it's really proving to be a test potentially for 2022 in the midterm elections to see how Democratic messaging will work out. And you have seen Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic candidate there. He has made comments about President Biden and his popularity in the state of Virginia. And he has made it quite clear he's getting a little nervous about his race in the context of this infrastructure debate and the reconciliation bill that we were just talking about. He has made it clear that he feels that it would be better for his race if they could go ahead and get that legislation passed. But the deadline, or rather a target date for Democrats for that, is October 31st, which cuts it quite close to Election Day in November in Virginia.
And you've been following some big names showing up or planning to show up in Virginia to try to swing things. Who is visiting?
Well, we know for sure that former President Barack Obama will be coming out to campaign for Terry McAuliffe in Virginia. Now, this is very important because Democrats see Hispanic voters and Black voters as being very important to turning out in Virginia, not just for this race, but for the midterms across the country. They believe that if they can get turnout from their base, then that is what will decide these elections in favor of Democrats. And so the former president, Barack Obama, heading to one of the key areas in which Terry McAuliffe would need to turn out Black voters, the Richmond area.
4 years ago, big Democratic wins in Virginia kind of raised hopes for Democrats of House and Senate majorities. Maybe a year later, signs of maybe an impending blue wave. Are people going to be looking at whatever the outcome here is as a sign of things to come in 2022?
They will absolutely be looking at it that way, particularly because even as you look at the breakdown of the state where they have Democratic senators, and Joe Biden again won the election in Virginia quite handily by double digits, you still have a situation where, for whatever reason, capturing the gubernatorial races have been harder for Democrats in the state. And so that will be one reason why they'll be looking to see what messages they can glean from this potentially for Democrats as they try to compete in 2022 on some of these same messages.
Talking to Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent for McClatchy. She is with us today for our weekly roundup of the top stories in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Related to our talk about Virginia there, are you watching that race? And do you have hopes or fears for which party might have the momentum going into 2022? Do you think Democrats can keep their slim majorities and basically tie in the Senate? Do you think things will swing the other way? What issues are on your mind as we're heading into those elections next year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Francesca Chambers is with us from McClatchy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. A couple questions for you. What issues are at the top of your mind as we head into the 2022 election season? And coming up in just a few moments, we'll check out a Biden administration policy saying federal agencies should look at the impact of plans, of rules on women and on gender inequality. Do you think that's something you want the federal government to be focused on? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Francesca, before we move on from prospects for Virginia and for elections in 2022, is there a sense among Democrats that, hey, they could lose the House and or Senate next year for their big projects, their infrastructure bills, for example? It's now or never. Is that lending some sense of urgency to them?
That is part of the reason there's a sense of urgency that if they lose they could potentially lose the House and Senate, so they wouldn't be able to do it down the line. But the reverse is also true. Democrats also think that if they don't accomplish something, they don't get infrastructure passed or some of these programs, then they won't have anything to take to the voters in order to be able to ask them to vote for them again. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword in that way.
Now, infrastructure, we've been waiting on infrastructure bills for years, way before the Biden administration. Seemed like some things were closing in on votes, and then timelines went back. What is the latest, Francesca, on when these two separate infrastructure packages, the more traditional infrastructure and the human infrastructure, as the Biden administration has called it, where are we on those right now?
Well, it continues to be infrastructure week in Washington, as we like to say. And now we have the Senate that's out of session this week. And so you could expect to see negotiations next week start to get a little bit more robust. But even with the Senate being out, we did hear from Senator Bernie Sanders, who is helping to lead these negotiations in the Senate as the budget committee chair, say yesterday that the time is now, that the time is up. He called out Senators Manchin and Sinema by name to reporters, saying that they need to decide which programs they want to cut and which programs they'd be willing to see in the spending bill in order to get down to the amount that Senator Manchin specifically says that he would like to see.
And how drastic, how big are the cuts from that $3.5 trillion over 10 years? That's been the number for quite a while now.
We don't know the answer to that yet because the White House has said they don't want to negotiate in public. So it's unclear whether or not we'll see something like a sunset for some of the programs in which they'd last less than 10 years in order to cut the price tag, or if some programs that the president proposed will just be cut from the bill entirely.
Talking to Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent for McClatchy. It's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Francesca, I want to spend some time on a piece that you wrote. You've been following this gender policy council story from the Biden administration. What kind of things are we hearing there?
So the Gender Policy Council, which President Biden established in March of this year, and it was the first council of this type that reports directly to a president, although there have been similar initiatives in the past to a lesser extent, is he had called on it to create a strategy for gender equality and equity. And that council has now turned in the strategy and it will be released within weeks. What does the strategy say? Well, they will direct federal agencies to put gender front and center in their policymaking processes. Now, how exactly they'll go about that can be up to the agencies. the White House will give them a blueprint for how they could do these things, but the agencies will have to identify which policies in which they think there is gender inequality and other areas in which they think that they could make improvements. It'll be up to them to make those decisions about policy.
So the why and the how, or the how and the what, are still a little fuzzy. What's the why? What are the reasons that the Biden administration is giving for having this focus on gender impacts of rules?
Well, the reason the White House says that this is important is because the policies can potentially negatively affect women if that question isn't being asked in the first place, which is how will this policy impact women? But the White House has also said a focus of its work from the very beginning would be some of these issues that the Gender Policy Council is touching on. Those would include pay equity and also women's unemployment at this time. So there are other things that the Gender Policy Council is also working on, including violence against women.
And a foreign policy comes up in this, too. This is not just a domestic issue, right?
That's right. Foreign policy and trade. And the reason those two things come up is this. In foreign assistance, there are groups that are working with the White House say that you could give more money or direct more money to women's groups in other countries. The other reason it comes up when it comes to trade is the idea of whether or not there should be preferential treatment for countries that do not discriminate against women in their laws. So there's a lot of different areas in which, once the strategy itself is given to agencies, that the agencies could then say, here are the areas in which we want to focus on. And then after that comes about the hard work of changing those policies all around.
And then you also wrote about concerns from some advocacy groups that this might sound nice. There aren't a lot of resources that they can point to going into that. What did you hear in response from this Gender Policy Council in the White House?
Well, the White House says that they think that they're well-resourced. At the same time, they're also looking to expand the number of people that they have. But advocates are concerned that all this work, when we talk about the issues and we're talking foreign policy, trade, extensively when it comes to domestic issues too, including into paid family leave, childcare, any number of issues, that the council and the number of staffers it has is being spread too thin potentially to work on all of the things that the president said in the executive order he would like to see them work on, but also the council has been telling advocates in their conversations that they would be tackling also.
So when might we in the public see an impact from this effort?
Well, it could be years for the entire strategy to be implemented. While it could be as early as this month before we see the strategy, then the agencies, again, will have to come up with their own plans to identify which things that they'd like to work on and then put those processes and the implementation into place. But the Gender Policy Council already has been helping the White House with its response to the Texas abortion law. And one of the things that has helped with there is coordinating with the Department of Justice, the White House Counsel's Office, and the Health and Human Services Department, for one.
One more story you tweeted about today, Francesca, on the vaccine mandate through the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, requiring a lot of workplaces to require vaccines. It came up at a press conference today, it sounds like, on the timing, when that's going to actually kick in, which I think a lot of people are pretty interested in. What do we and don't we know at this point?
Businesses also want to know when that's going to kick in. Mm-hmm. So what we do know at this point is that it's been submitted for review, the rule that OSHA put together, that the president previewed, and it's now with the Office of Management and Budget at the White House, which is reviewing it. And as the White House said today, we're probably and unfortunately going to all find out at the same time what's in the rule, because it will be posted publicly to the Federal Register and we'll all be able to see it by refreshing.
So what stories are you watching for now over the next week or two, Francesca? Senate out of session, you mentioned, but still a lot going on.
Well, the Senate will be coming back into session early next week. And so what we'll be watching for is whether or not they can come to a deal. Democrats can come to a deal on this spending bill. And importantly, even if they do come to a deal, what is in it? Which programs stay? Which programs go? How long do they last? There's still a number of unanswered questions about that. And largely in Washington, until those questions are answered, a lot of things are frozen.
And I've heard skepticism and optimism about whether something is going to come out of this, just from your sense. And there's a lot of moving parts, I know, Francesca. Are we going to end up with an infrastructure bill or two infrastructure bills? Or what are the chances of it all falling apart still?
Well, the two bills would have to move together from everything that I'm hearing from Democrats. If you have the bipartisan infrastructure bill, then you're also going to have some other secondary spending bill that's passed only by Democrats and includes other parts of the president's agenda. But it's very up in the air right now as to what that second bill will include. Now, one thing that progressives and the president are united on is they do not want to cut climate change provisions. So those look to be one thing that you can likely count on to be in that. But there is disagreement beyond that about what is essential to put in this bill and what the president and his party could potentially try to tackle later.
Francesca, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Francesca Chambers. She's the White House correspondent for McClatchy, and she joined us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, we'll hear the next episode of the WPR podcast, Mapped Out. This week, look back at what happened in the first election after Wisconsin's 2011 redistricting process. And you're thinking, uh-oh, I'm coming in three episodes in? Don't worry. The first two episodes are both archived at WPR.org. You can catch up with what you missed there. While you're there, find out how to live stream the Ideas Network on your computer or other device, and check out our extensive archives of all our conversations here on the Ideas Network. Also, you can find out how to load the Wisconsin Public Radio app onto your smartphone so you can take WPR with you anywhere. Also, check us out on social media, including right now, on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We have a question for you for a conversation for tomorrow. What is your favorite, what's the best out of the way, off the beaten path travel thing, event, place, restaurant, you name it, you have ever encountered or discovered? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Looking forward to hearing some of your stories and sharing them on the program tomorrow. Coming up, Mapped Out, the podcast on redistricting. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. Stick with us here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, have a green Halloween. Get advice on eco-friendly celebrations on the spooky holiday. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Wisconsin's electoral maps had an impact on state politics almost as soon as they were drawn during the redistricting process in 2011. That's the subject of the latest episode of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out. Last week, we heard how Republicans created that new set of boundaries behind closed doors after winning control of the state legislature and the governor's office. Today, Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden look back at the first major elections held with our current maps in place. To at least one state lawmaker, the balance of power felt different right away.
By the time the redistricting maps are passed in 2011, Republican Dale Schultz has been in the legislature for nearly 30 years.
I think in my political career, I did over 1,000 parades.
Like generations of Wisconsin lawmakers before him, he's seen the pendulum of power swing. In the Senate, where he spent most of his career, he's seen control flip back and forth 7 times.
And he's been through 3 cycles of redistricting. The last two were under divided government.
And so there was a check and a balance. Either we had a governor of the opposite party or one house or both houses of the legislature, you know, were different from the executive branch. And that forced some compromises.
But in 2011, things are different. As you'll remember from our last episode, Republicans run the show. And by run the show, we mean they control the governor's office, the Senate, and the Assembly.
And this lets them control the entire redistricting process. And when GOP leaders and their lawyers set up shop at a private law firm across the street from the Capitol, Dale Schultz is one of the rank-and-file Republican lawmakers who visits to look at the new boundaries of his district.
Dale Schultz signs the confidentiality agreement and votes for the map. And at the time, he doesn't think much about it. Until the next election.
And we know in our hearts that for the United States of America, the best is yet to come.
In November of 2012, Barack Obama wins a second term in the White House. In Wisconsin, it's not one of those super close elections that seems so common here. It's decisive. Obama beats Republican Mitt Romney by more than 200,000 votes.
This spills over to races down the ballot, too. Statewide, Democrats receive more than half of the votes across all assembly races.
You know, it was pretty much of a Democratic landslide. We got wiped out. And then somebody said to me, well, don't worry. We're still in control of the assembly. I said, how can that be? I said,
despite receiving fewer than 50% of the total votes, Republicans win 60 out of 99 seats in the Wisconsin Assembly. And they preserve their majority in the Senate, too.
Schultz, who has spent decades in politics, says he can't figure it out. The math doesn't add up. In such a Democratic year, he expects Democrats to win in the legislature, too.
And it was at that point that the light switch went on, and I realized what a mousetrap had been built.
Schultz realizes it's the map. Republicans had drawn legislative district lines that protected them, even when Democrats performed better.
Schultz and the state of Wisconsin have now seen the 2011 map in action.
From WPR Reports, I'm Bridget Bowden.
And I'm Sean Johnson. This is Mapped Out. The map that Schultz saw in action was the result of countless decisions by mapmakers. Where to draw a line? What shape to make a district? They got to make those calls.
So what do these decisions look like? To find out, let's go on a tour of Wisconsin to places that changed after the 2011 map.
Let's start with DeForest, a village in Dane County.
DeForest is about a half hour north of Madison, where lots of its residents work. Some big highways are nearby. You see lots of new houses here because it's growing fast.
And the village has built lots of new stuff to make it a nice place to live. There's a new downtown park shelter, a splash pad, and a trail along the Ahara River.
Before 2011, it was represented by one representative and one senator. After the new map, it got a little more complicated.
Can you tell us where we're standing right now?
We are on Yahara Street, which is the northern part of DeForest, and it is actually a boundary line between two different assembly districts and two different Senate districts.
DeForest, a village of around 10,000 people, was sliced up under the new map. One of the dividing lines went right in front of Abby Lowry's house.
One day, Lowry hears about a bill being pushed at the state capitol. It would have allowed for the sale of water utilities to private companies. And this was right after the Flint, Michigan water crisis.
And so that kind of set alarm bells off in my head. I had two little kids at the time. I think they were like 4 and 1. And I was very concerned about that. I didn't really hear anybody in town really talking about it much. And
Lowry wants to do something about this. So she makes a bunch of flyers to hand out to her neighbors. She wants them to contact their elected officials.
But there's a problem. Because she lives on a line, some of her neighbors have different representatives.
And then I start going door to door, and I had the map out on my phone, and I realized it wasn't even the whole street that was divided in half.
Because DeForest wasn't just split in two. It was split into three assembly districts and three Senate districts. That's six different lawmakers representing this one village. In the world of redistricting, this is often referred to as cracking.
There are so many district lines that it can even be confusing for people who live there.
So I point to this corner. Which district is this?
Assembly District 42,
Senate District 14.
Okay, and across the street over here?
Assembly District 37, Senate District 13.
How about that corner over there?
you're challenging me. Okay.
Now, Lowry is on the village board, and contacting lawmakers is part of her job.
I know the last time that we sent a letter to our legislators, we commented like, we got to do all six of them. Make sure we get it to all six.
Now, you might hear this and think, six lawmakers for one village, six people working for you. Not bad, right?
But Lowry says it's not like that at all. She says they don't show up for stuff like parades or public meetings because those lawmakers consider other communities home.
I strongly feel if we were all in one district, like one assembly district, one Senate district, I think that person would show up. I don't know how they couldn't. We're pushing.
Because DeForest is such a small part of each of their districts, Lowry says it's like an afterthought. Instead of more power, DeForest has less.
Okay, so that's DeForest, a community that was cracked into six legislative districts.
2.5 hours northwest of DeForest is Eau Claire. And what happened there is kind of the opposite. It's a strategy known as packing.
So Eau Claire is much bigger than DeForest. It has about 70,000 people, too many for a single assembly district. It has to be divided up somehow.
The way they used to do it before 2011 pretty much split the city into north and south. In the north, you had one assembly district and one Senate district. And in the south, you had the same.
All of these districts included some parts of the city and some rural areas. They were a mix.
This made a lot of sense to Eau Claire resident Wendy Sue Johnson.
So, Eau Claire is a two high school town. It's a two zip code town. It has two rivers going through it that makes it very clear when you're on one side of town versus the other.
And so, Johnson describes herself as a lifelong Northsider, and she's had a lot of jobs here. High school social studies teacher, lawyer, even dance coach. She's also pretty political. She was on the school board, and she once ran as a Democrat for the state assembly.
She says before 2011, assembly and Senate races in the area used to be really competitive.
It used to be that we had competitive districts in this area, and it would swing with the mood of the electorate, right? So if there's a nationwide, Democratic wave or a nationwide Republican wave, it usually would play out in western Wisconsin. And that has not happened since 2010.
And the numbers bear that out. The four districts that used to represent Eau Claire were amazingly close. You'd have a Democrat win by less than a percent one year, and then a couple years later, a Republican would win by less than a percent.
Both assembly seats and both Senate seats were up for grabs almost every election. Those candidates had to fight for each and every vote.
In 2011, Republican mapmakers changed that. They drew one assembly district that pretty much only included the city of Eau Claire.
And if you look at it on a map, it looks kind of like a bullseye. One small urban district surrounded by much bigger rural districts.
So the urban district, it's very Democratic. Republicans really can't win there.
And those rural districts that surround the city, Democrats don't really have a chance in those.
Wendy Sue Johnson found this out in 2018 when she ran for the assembly. She knew she faced long odds, but she wanted to give people a choice in the election.
And in 2018, a year that saw Wisconsin elect Democrats for governor, U.S. Senate, and every other statewide office, Wendy Sue Johnson lost her race badly, by about 15%.
Johnson had seen enough. She said she would never run for office in this district again.
Not under the gerrymandered maps, no. You're spending almost a year of your time knocking doors and making phone calls and talking to the public, every spare moment. If we have different maps, possibly.
So before the new map, Eau Claire was perhaps the most competitive area of Wisconsin. It could swing back and forth any given election and swing control of the legislature.
But under the new map, people like Johnson say it's not even worth running. These races are predetermined. We finish our tour in Wisconsin's biggest city, Milwaukee.
Milwaukee is one of the most complicated parts of the map, and that's in part because so many people live here.
Including Helen Harris. She lives on the northwest side of the city in a house that she and her husband built.
And from the very beginning, it has been a mixture of white, black, Asian, Hispanic, and it's a very interesting and friendly kind of neighborhood to live in.
Before the 2011 map, all the legislative districts in this area looked different from each other. They were all sorts of shapes and sizes.
But after Republicans redrew the map in 2011, they created a bunch of districts that stretched from the edge of Milwaukee west into the city's suburbs.
The Republican-dominated suburbs. So some of these Milwaukee Democrats, like Helen Harris, suddenly found themselves with very conservative representatives who did not call Milwaukee home.
So we were kind of chopped off and added to a heavily Republican district that stretched out throughout the city and a couple of other counties.
A couple of these districts are competitive, but not Helen Harris's. In the last election, the Republican candidate won unopposed.
It's not just about political party, though. Harris feels like her new representatives have been constantly at odds with the city she's proud to live in.
There also seems to be a lot of distrust in some Republican districts about the city and a lot of hatred of Milwaukee and Milwaukee Public Schools. And I was an employee of Milwaukee Public Schools. I went to Milwaukee Public Schools. My children went to Milwaukee Public Schools. And I currently have two grandchildren in Milwaukee Public Schools.
Harris is the kind of person who writes letters to her legislators. She likes to have a relationship with them. She at least wants them to give her the time of day.
But Harris and her new district are worlds apart. At the end of the day, she says she feels like she doesn't have a voice anymore.
Because my vote doesn't count. My vote doesn't count because of the way the legislators deliberately set these guidelines for redistricting.
Now, these district lines need to go somewhere. Helen Harris lives just a few blocks away from a Democratic district with a representative who shares her views. Someone is always going to be on the edge of that line.
But if you step back for a minute and you look at the whole map, you can see a pattern. These things happening in DeForest, Eau Claire, and Milwaukee. In the big picture, they all benefit the same party, the Republicans.
And the Democrats, they saw the writing on the wall, and they sued.
More on that after the break.
We're listening to the newest episode of the WPR Report's Mapped Out podcast, looking at the political boundaries drawn in 2011 and how they affected our elections to this day. We'll hear more about the controversy and legal action around those maps coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening to the latest episode of the WPR podcast, Mapped Out, telling the story of Wisconsin's electoral maps, how they were drawn in 2011, and the impact they've had ever since. As we heard a few moments ago, the advantage they gave Republicans was clear to many in the state capitol. That led to court challenges.
When we said Democrats could see this Republican advantage coming, we're talking about before the map was even drawn.
They literally file a lawsuit about a month before a new map is even introduced in the legislature. It goes to a three-judge panel because that's how federal redistricting cases work.
Their argument is pretty basic. The population has changed. The old map is out of date. And if the legislature and governor don't draw a new map soon, a federal court should step in and do it for them.
A Madison lawyer named Doug Poland signs on. At the time, he's working for a big firm doing commercial litigation. He's hired because he knows his way around a courtroom, but he's not an expert in redistricting.
I had never handled any kind of a political or election law case in my life. I don't think I could have even told you what redistricting was, even in a very general way.
He gets brought up to speed fast, and once the map is introduced, the original lawsuit snowballs.
They claim that the new map violates the Voting Rights Act.
That it disenfranchises hundreds of thousands of people.
That it violates those traditional redistricting criteria. You know, compact, communities of interest, local boundaries.
And the lawsuit claims that the map is a partisan gerrymander, that Republicans drew it with politics in mind, silencing the voices of Democratic voters.
Even before this case makes it to trial, it's clear these judges are mad.
Because the secretive tactics Republicans and their lawyers used to draw these maps spill over to this courtroom. They initially refused to turn over certain documents.
But the judges aren't having it. they issue a scathing order.
No, really, it is harsh.
They call out the Republican lawyers by name and accuse them of disinformation, foot dragging, and obfuscation.
Also, sandbagging and hide the ball trial tactics.
And they accuse the legislature and its attorneys of, quote, giving every appearance of flailing wildly in a desperate attempt to hide the redistricting process from the public.
And Poland says this kind of talk from federal judges is
highly unusual. The fact that lawyers are called out by name several times by a 3-judge federal panel. Highly significant. Very unusual.
But even though the judges are mad, in the end, they only make one tiny change to the map, moving a single district line in a Latino neighborhood of Milwaukee.
The court decides that the map does not violate traditional redistricting criteria. So even though the judges had major issues with the way things were handled, they basically uphold the map.
Poland says that's the nature of redistricting law.
So there were a number of things that were done that were really troublesome, and we raised those. And the court said, we're troubled by them too, but we don't think that they rise to the level of a legal violation.
And the partisan gerrymandering claim that Democrats started to bring in this case, they just drop it. Because in the world of federal court, partisan gerrymandering lawsuits never go anywhere.
And then we were sort of done in the trial court, because that's the way things work.
Democrats had basically lost this battle, but there was another fight they were gearing up for.
We've said several times during this podcast that Republicans were running everything when the maps were drawn, and those maps helped them cement their power in the state legislature for the next decade.
However, there was a very brief moment when that wasn't the case.
In 2011 and 2012, after Republicans overhaul Wisconsin's union laws, people are mad. There are a bunch of recall elections, and Scott Walker's is the biggest. On June 5th, 2012, he wins. It's a huge blow to Democrats.
But that same day, Democrats just barely flip one state Senate seat, and that's just enough to give them the state Senate's majority.
Democrat Mark Miller suddenly finds himself the Senate's majority leader. And those private lawyers who helped Republicans draw the map, now they work for him.
We asked them for all their files on the redistricting. All the memos, all the texts, all the emails that had been transpired between leadership and others.
Miller takes all of those redistricting documents and posts every page of them online. He says he was trying to expose what he thought was a secretive process.
It was a real treasure trove of information, but then you had no what to look for.
And you know who knew what to look for? One of the Democratic redistricting lawyers, Doug Poland.
In this trove of redistricting information that's now online for the world to see, Poland notices some stuff he's never seen before, stuff that should have been turned over during the redistricting lawsuit.
And now I'm looking at dozens of documents that haven't been produced. Now I knew something was wrong.
So even though the redistricting trial is over and the map is mostly upheld, Poland notifies those federal judges who were so frustrated with Republicans.
And those judges have seen enough. They order Republicans to turn over the actual computers that were used to draw the maps so the Democrats can investigate them.
What they find leads them all the way to the United States Supreme Court. More on that next week on Mapped Out. Mapped Out is reported by Sean Johnson
and Bridget Bowden. We're produced by Brad Kohlberg, edited by Noah Ovshinsky, music by Carl Christensen, additional support from Adam Friedrich.
Digital editing by John K. Wilson and digital direction by David Hyland.
Photography by Angela Major, artwork by John Nichols.
You can see more at wpr.org/mappedout.
You can hear new episodes of Mapped Out each Wednesday for the next several weeks here on Central Time and Thursdays on The Morning Show. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, anxiety can be a serious problem, but there are ways to cope with it and even use it for good. We'll get advice from the author of the new book, Good Anxiety. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. When you go traveling, do you hit the famous tourist spots or look for things that are off the beaten path? I do a little of both, but I always enjoy discovering something out of the ordinary, whether the traveling is far away or just a few blocks away. Tomorrow, here on Central Time, travel and science writer Gemma Tarlak from Atlas Obscura is back with us to share the joys of finding places off the beaten path around the world in our own communities. Jenna has been all over the world on all seven continents. Yes, even that one. She's done karaoke, apparently, in Antarctica. She's going to tell us about some of the unique places on the planet. I plan to live vicariously through her experiences, like I'm probably never going to go to Antarctica myself. And we'll want to hear from you about your favorite travel discoveries, the unique things that you have seen and done here in Wisconsin or around the world. You can get us started right now. Share your story on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Tell us about the cool event you saw, the little restaurant you stumbled across, that beautiful natural area. And we could share some of your stories on the show tomorrow. Maybe I'll mention the time when just a couple days after moving to Wisconsin, I stumbled across the annual Cow Chip Throwing Championship. It's an event to remember. A record was broken. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.